From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories of high strangeness. Here's what's happening. Well, you show your ID, you take off your shoes, you hand over your carry-on, and maybe, just maybe, you get a pat-down. TSA checkpoints are a hassle for travelers, but you've got to accept it. But now new layers of security could further test your patience. Recent attacks on international airports in Brussels and Istanbul, Turkey, have some government agencies now looking at expanded security perimeters. In both cases, terrorists in Brussels and Istanbul were able to bring bombs into airports but not pass checkpoints. Moving those checkpoints to the curb or inspecting cars as they first enter the airport could keep tourists and terrorists and just about everybody else miserable from doing what they do. But you know what? It may be a necessity. I've always wondered about that as well, how vulnerable airports are before you get to the checkpoints. Taliban militants launching a twin suicide attack targeting a convoy of buses carrying Afghan police cadets outside of the capital, killing 37 people, mostly policemen, and wounding 40 others there. Well, the tables have turned this week in the White House watch. After trailing Hillary Clinton by 5 points for the prior 2 weeks, Donald Trump has now taken a 4-point lead. It's a Rasmussen report poll. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, where did this little surge come from, John?
Well, I mean, these polls vacillate, as you know, George. I mean, depending on who, you know, what the database is that they're using, the kind of polling, the methodology. And the aggregate polling, which is really what most of the political scientists look at, still has Hillary up right now, about 4.9%. However, that's a lot less. Trump seems to be closing at this point. And remember that we're in the very early rounds of this prize fight. And while Hillary's won, and I think the narrative that's been painted and the relentless sort of attacks by the media, including his own party, have been a bad 2 weeks for Trump. But the other side of that is that the negatives mounting with Hillary, a lot of revelations about, you know, the emails and, you know, the FBI, the ongoing FBI investigation into whether she violated the Espionage Act by transmitting classified or top secret information, is really a boom that could be lowered over the Clinton campaign at any time, prompting Bernie Sanders to not concede his, you know, his position right now. He's not conceded to Hillary because he thinks that there's a possibility that, you know, she may be out as a candidate. Now, given that the that Loretta Lynch just met with Bill Clinton today, and that there's a perception, at least out there, that the Justice Department, even with a recommendation by the FBI, wouldn't pursue charges against Hillary, there's still a lot of angst out there among voters, and especially the vast majority of independents, which, you know, Hillary and Trump are appealing to. Mm-hmm. And so far, Trump has a real advantage with independent voters. So this is a long way from a done deal right now, even though it's painted that way in the media.
Okay, John, let's check in with you sometime next week. Have a great Independence weekend. Police captured a naked man seen dancing and flailing his arms around New York's Times Square Thursday morning, making it to the top of the plaza's red staircase there as hundreds of New Yorkers and tourists took photos and videos of this nut. He was running around screaming, "Donald Trump, where are you?" He got arrested. More than half of those who have tested positive for the Zika virus in New York City had traveled in recent months to the Dominican Republic. The results were a stark reminder that as summer travel season begins, many of the most popular destinations for New Yorkers in the Caribbean and Latin America pose a serious health risk, especially for pregnant women. Let's check in with Dr. Gary Ridenour. Gary, I wanted to ask you about Zika. If somebody just gets bitten by an infected mosquito, a guy, for example, what happens to them if they get the virus?
Well, about 80% of the people that get bitten today don't even know that they've had the infection. And so they will either go to the Dominican Republic, which is where 140 people came from, get bitten, and come back to the United States with the virus, or they live in the Dominican Republic, get bitten, and come back to the United States. The big point is there are no infected mosquitoes in the United States.
So far.
So far. I said summer. It's summertime, and the living in the, is easy, and Zika is in New York City.
And the Olympics, are they going to be a disaster?
I think what is going to happen is that it's going to be a pseudo-panic going on already. CDC has a 50-page pamphlet out that I read, and it's worthless. The CDC cut the Ebola vaccine money. They took $50 million out of state and local health emergency response programs. And, of course, all the Ebola funds have been transferred to Zika, and everybody's shooting in different directions, and nothing seems to be coordinated.
All right, Gary, thank you so much. In New York City, about 233 people have tested positive for Zika. 140 of them recently arrived from the Dominican Republic. Environmental scientists have declared a global climate emergency after the Northern Hemisphere jet stream was found to have crossed the equator, bringing unprecedented changes to the world's weather patterns. What does that all mean? We'll check in with Dr. Tim Ball about that and much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Dr. Tim Ball with us for this hour. We'll take calls pretty soon with him as well as we talk about climate change. His book is called The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science. He is a renowned environmental consultant, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Tim, welcome back.
Well, thank you, George. Thanks for the opportunity.
I am in St. Louis for another week. I've been here for a few weeks. I had an event a few weeks ago, and I got to tell you, Tim, they had no spring this year. Spring in St. Louis is always wonderful. They went straight from winter to summer with high 90-degree weather. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is that the jet stream waves, the major jet stream, which is the polar jet, is changing its wave pattern, and it's doing that because the Earth is in a cooling trend, and as the Earth cools down, the waves in the jet stream, instead of being long, low-amplitude waves, what we call a zonal flow, they become more meridional, that is, more north-south. And so what happens with that is that you get warm air pushing north in one area and cold air pushing south in another area. And that's creating the patterns that we're experiencing right now. It's nothing new. It's nothing unusual. It's gone on forever, but it's just a changing pattern due to the cooling. But, of course, the government are trapped because they're telling everybody that it's warming and this is all due to warming, and it isn't. It's like their argument that, with the warming, there's going to be more severe weather. We haven't had more severe weather. Hurricanes, tornadoes, far fewer. But now we're starting to see the changing wind patterns and the changing patterns that you're commenting on. But there's another important thing here, George, in terms of perception. You know, and everybody's experienced this. You're introduced to somebody, and it seems like after that, every time you turn around, there they are, or there their name is. They were always there. They were just not part of your perceptional world.
It's like when you buy a car, all of a sudden you see that model everywhere.
Exactly. And that's what's happening now, of course, that the weather and the climate has become a political agenda. As you saw the Paris Climate Conference with Obama saying climate change was a bigger threat than terrorism. And the media, of course, are reporting all of these events. And everybody's saying, oh, there's more in the news and I'm seeing more. The reality is that it's not more unusual. But that's part of what's been going on with this whole process. You see, people don't know what is normal or what is natural. So they're able to come along and say, oh, this is not normal, this is not natural, knowing that people don't know what's normal or natural. And this is part of the political game that's being told. And this story that's come out today about the jet stream crossing the equator, as if somehow this is new and unusual and never happened before. And just to put this in perspective, George, we have official records of government, by official, I mean government records, which cover about 25% of the world's surface, so we've got very limited coverage. But the longest records we've got are about 120 years in length. And, of course, that then becomes the measure of what's going on. But let's put that in perspective. Because the world, according to science, is about 4.54 billion years old, and 120 years... as a sample size of 4.54 billion years, is 0.000002%. And so out of that percentage sample, they're making all sorts of things. Oh, this has never happened before. This is abnormal. This is unusual. And it simply is not true. And of course, it's because they want to sell the idea that humans and their, particularly their development of burning of fossil fuels is changing the climate, mm-hmm. and that we've got to get rid of nation states and we've got to have one world government because only a centralized world government can deal with this, and that's what the push is. But in terms of the science, what's going on today is not abnormal at all.
In the movie The Day After Tomorrow, yeah. where everything just seemed to change overnight, it started with the jet stream. So with this change in the jet stream, is it temporary or is it permanent? What is it?
No, with the changes in the jet stream, this going from zonal to meridional flow, it can last for a decade. It can last for a century. For example, the 14th century, when the Earth's climate was coming out of the medieval warm period into the colder, heading towards the Little Ice Age around 1680, the 14th century was an in-between period where you had mostly this meridional flow, and you had a situation, excuse me,
got a little frog in your throat there, Timothy, or what?
It must be global warming.
It's got to be.
But anyway,
or somebody's out to get you.
Yeah, what you had happening in Europe was that you had cool, wet summers with harvest failures and diseases and so on. But you also had warm, wet winters. And so diseases survived, and you got the plagues, and you had harvest failures. It's exactly the same thing that we're seeing around the world today. But that change of the jet stream flow lasted for almost the whole century of the 14th century. So the changes vary in length depending on what time of the climate record you're looking at.
Well, I've got to say, Tim, that with the changes that have occurred, we're really in cycles, aren't we? Whether the sun does this or whether there are earth patterns, but these are cycles that have come and gone since the beginning of time, aren't they?
Well, they are, but you see, here, this is the problem. And this started, because I've been studying climate since 1960, but in the 1990s, there was a big debate between the Western scientists studying climate, and they were saying that the weather is chaotic, it's unpredictable, and that's where you heard those stories about, oh, a butterfly flaps its wings in Japan and you get a storm in California 2 weeks later and so on. The Eastern Bloc nations, Russia or Soviet Union as it was then, and China, and I've worked with the climatologists from both of those nations, they were saying, no, what you're saying, that the climate is cyclical, and all you got to do is figure out what all the cycles are and how they interact with each other, and the net result is the weather that you get on a daily basis. The media and the Western world picked this up as a Cold War debate, that it was simply a difference because of the Cold War. It wasn't. It was a fundamental scientific disagreement. And as I said, the Western world, I used to tease the people at the NOAA and NASA and so on. I said, you better hope chaos theory is right, because then you'll have an excuse for your forecast being so wrong. But the Chinese and the Russians have, for the longest time, and by that I mean at least 200-300 years, studied the cycles of weather. In fact, in the stock market, one of the most famous cycles is called the Kondratiev cycle, which causes drought in the middle latitudes and causes a failure of the grain supply and influences the world economies. And so there's a lot of people in the business world that follow these cycles. But here's the difficulty. When they started using climate for a political vehicle, and it started in about 1990 with this group called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they set about to prove that humans were causing global warming. And so they set up this group through the World Meteorological Organization, which is the United Nations organization. That then gave them control over every national weather agency throughout the world. And, of course, through them, they then tell the politicians, oh, here's what's going on. This is what you need to be dealing with. So they had direct control of the politicians. And by them, I mean Maurice Strong in particular, mm-hmm. at the United Nations. And so... they then said, okay, well, we're going to study this whole climate thing, the IPCC. The very first thing they did, George, was they defined climate in a very narrow way. And one of the things, and you and I have talked about this before, but it's worth repeating, I used to think commissions of inquiry were great ideas because you say, oh, good, we're finally going to get the politics out of an issue. But what actually happens is it takes the politicians off the hook and, in fact, gives them more control. And the reason it takes the politicians off the hook is because the media come along and say, well, what about this? No, I can't talk about it. I'm waiting for the report from the commission. And then they go back to their offices and with the bureaucrats set the terms of reference for the commission. And you know, on your program, one of the big issues has been the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Right? Okay. Well, I was watching Chief Justice Warren one time being interviewed before he passed away, and they said to him, why didn't you look at the Mafia Dallas connection? And his comment was, it wasn't in my terms of reference.
Jeez.
In other words, he had been told, don't go there. Now what has become the biggest part of the conspiracy theory, the whole that Mafia connection and Jack Ruby and so on and so forth. Well, what they did with the climate, when they defined the terms of reference for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they defined climate change as only those changes in climate caused by humans, which means then you don't look at the sun, you don't look at the oceans, you don't look at any of those things, you only look at one of the greenhouse gases. Now, the greenhouse gases, the total are water vapor, CO2, and methane. And most people, they comprise almost 100% of the greenhouse gases. Most people don't know that of those three, water vapor is 95% of the greenhouse gases. CO2 is only 4%. So they narrowed the study down to just CO2 and then only the human portion. So, well, why didn't they look at water vapor? Well, they said, well, humans produce water vapor, and it's a greenhouse gas, and we put water vapor into the atmosphere. But the amount we produce is so small relative to the total amount of water vapor in the atmosphere that it's insignificant. So immediately then they've eliminated what are most likely are what we know are the major causes of climate change. And it was all done by setting the terms of reference, just like the Warren Commission. The governments limited it and predetermined the outcome of what's going on. And so this is why we're in the mess that we're in with the climate and the use of it for a political agenda. But George, there's one other thing that people need to understand. And again, I learned this working with the Chinese climatologists, for example. North Americans don't realize, and even British people don't realize, that other cultures see the world and think about the world completely different than we do.
Well, that's true. Hang with us, Tim. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and chat a little bit more about climate change. We are getting more volatile storms, that's for sure. And we're going to take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Tim, before we go back to calls, a few more questions, but you wanted to wrap up talking about other countries and how they look at all
what,
of this.
Thank you, George. What I wanted to say was that working with the Chinese climatologists, and by the way, they were in Canada because they wanted to study how we were able to grow far more crops in cold climates. They wanted to expand into Manchuria food production. But anyway, they look at the world completely different than we do, and I always get a laugh out of when we're making deals with China, assuming they think and see the world the way we do. They see the world as everything on the planet is put there for the Chinese people. And all you got to do to see that is go to a Chinese food market, and everything that wriggles, swims, calls, fries, is there to be eaten, you know? And so it's completely different philosophy. But the Western world developed around the theme of what's called uniformitarianism, and it really emerged around the time of Darwin and the geologists at that time, Playfair, and it was the idea that change was very gradual over long periods of time. That started to be challenged in the, as I said, with the chaos theory and catastrophism, and Stephen Jay Gould, who did some wonderful work, and he said, well, it's relatively uniform, and then there are catastrophic events. But in fact, if you look at the long-term record, change and dramatic change is the normal. And just to put, I gave the 4.5 million or billion year age of the Earth, but you look at just 18,000 years ago, which in the age of the Earth is a fraction of a second ago.
It's nothing.
North America, most or over half of North America was covered with an ice sheet larger in area than the current Antarctic ice sheet. And all of that melted in about 5,000 years. And it wasn't due to Barney Rubble driving cars. So people have been educated to the belief that the change, any dramatic change or sudden change, is quote unquote not normal. Therefore, it must be something that humans are doing, and that's part of it. But the real agenda in the climate issue, and I'll just read you a couple of quotes here. One of the people that was instrumental in getting the whole global warming issue going was U.S. Senator Timothy Wirth, W-I-R-T-H, and he's now at the U.N. And he said this, and he said this in 1990, we've got to ride the global warming issue. Even if the theory of global warming is wrong, we will be doing the right thing. And then Christine Stewart, the Canadian Minister of the Environment at the time, said, no matter if the science of global warming is all phony, climate change provides the greatest opportunity to bring about justice and equality in the world. And then to put a cap on it, Otter Edenhofer, who was the co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Working Group 3, from 2008 to 2015, he said, one has to free oneself from the illusion that international climate policy is environmental policy. We redistribute de facto the world's wealth by climate policy. So you see the actual agenda and the hijacking of science for this political agenda, and of course that's why they're doing it now. They say, oh, you know, this is the you're going to hear it come out. They'll say 2016 is the warmest year on record.
Right. Well, are the storms, Tim, more violent than they were a few years ago?
No, there's no intensity in the storms. If you look at the intensity index for tornadoes, for example, there is no increase. You can get stronger winds because as that cold air pushes further south, the temperature contrast between the cold air and the warm air is greater, and that's what creates stronger winds. So within the storm itself, the wind patterns can be stronger, but overall, no, there's no greater intensity. As I said, the actual frequencies are less. And this is another of the lies that the IPCC were telling. They were saying with global warming, there will be more storms and more intense storms. Well, their theory was that the colder air, the polar air, would warm up more than the warm tropical air. that, in fact, scientifically, would create less storms, but they were saying it would create more storms. The reason it creates less storms is because, of course, the temperature difference across that polar front, and you hear John Holder and Obama's science are talking about the polar vortex and all of this stuff. None of that's new, but in fact, with a warmer polar region, you get the potential for less storms. So scientifically, they were wrong. As I said, the reason that you're seeing some intensity in the storms, and we'll see more, is because that cold air pushing further south and the temperature contrast between it and the warm air. And you'll see that with the number of thunderstorms these last week.
Well, they just keep rolling in. Hey, Tim, let's take some calls here before we get out of time here. Let's go to Chris in Clearwater, Florida, to get things started. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Oh, well, you know, that according to the EPA's own website, that CO2 with a global warming potential of 1 is 82% of greenhouse gases, and yet fluorinated gases account for 3%, but their global warming potential is thousands to tens of thousands that of CO2. So you take the CO2's 82% divided by fluorinated gases, 3%, you come out to 27.33, which is far less, obviously, than thousands to tens of thousands. So because fluorinated gases, if you want to call it a climate denier, I would say that, well, don't deny the toxicity and greater persistence that correlates thereto of fluorinated gases, which are hungry for electrons, so they quickly become fluorides. And, they're hungry for the electrons of other compounds or other elements, so that's how they bind to them. And so why don't we just put aside our differences as to whether we're climate deniers and forget about the Department of Justice trying to prosecute folks for denying climate change, and point out that let's just all unite under the fact that fluorinated gases being dumped into or emitted into our atmosphere by Mosaic Phosphate Mining and other phosphate mining companies, unregulated therefore, and unmonitored therefore, needs to be addressed.
All right, Tim, your reaction to that.
Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, he's absolutely right. Senator Whitehouse and trying to bring the RICO charges, racketeering charges against climate deniers.
Crazy.
And, of course, it's just absolutely outrage and the First Amendment and free speech and so on. But the difficulty with his comments are, first of all, he's using the EPA site. And what they've done there, and this started way back, in the 80s, when they were saying that methane was causing the global warming and it was the problem, and they were blaming the cattle. And you remember all the attacks on cattle,
mm-hmm.
and New Zealand passing taxes that each farmer had to pay 250 New Zealand dollars for the methane their cattle were passing. Well, methane is 0.009% of the total greenhouse gases. And when we pointed this out and said, look, it's so insignificant, that's when they came in with the comment that your caller used of the global warming potential. They created this argument, oh, well, yeah, it's a very small amount of the total, but it's far more effective in its ability to trap heat. And they said, and you can go and read the numbers, there's a huge range of numbers because there's no science behind it at all. And they said that one molecule of methane will trap as much heat as 26 molecules of CO2, which will trap as much as 10 molecules of water vapor. And this was the way they got around the number, or the fact that the numbers were so small. Now, the data that he's presenting about human additions are so small that they're insignificant against the natural totals. And when you vary water vapor, for example, by just 1%, it will cause more change than any change in CO2 or methane or any of the other factors. So every time that they something's come up to question their hypothesis that CO2 causes warming and CO2 is going to increase because of industry and therefore we're going to guarantee warming. Every time that something's come up to show that isn't true, they create these false numbers and phony numbers, and that's what he's quoting from that EPA site. And it's not justified.
Let's go to Charles in Los Angeles now. Charles, you're up.
Taking my call, yes.
Sure thing.
I wanted to ask your guest if, because since 1977, our federal government's been dumping chemtrails on us, aluminum oxide, ethyl diabromide, barium, crystal quartz powder, and I don't know how many others. And I've heard that this may be affecting our jet stream to give us a drought here in California. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, back in the Cold War, and the Russians were experimenting with very low frequency broadcasting, and it was swamping TV and radio signals all throughout Europe. And they say they were experimenting with weather modification. And just to put this in perspective, there's approximately the equivalent of 15 hydrogen bombs of energy in one thunderstorm, and there are 10,000 thunderstorms around the world at any given time. We went through this nonsense with the ozone and the so-called ozone hole, and there's somebody said, well, why don't we produce ozone at ground level and pump it up and boost the levels? It turned out that we would have to use every single scrap of wattage of energy that humans produce in total to produce that much ozone. The bigger problem with the spraying of the chemtrails is that it was being done for a couple of reasons. One was because of experimentation of bouncing radio waves off in the ionosphere. This started way back with before it became the HARRP, it was the HARP, H-A-R-P, High Altitude Research Project. And then it morphed into putting up these particles in order to block the sunlight to reduce global warming. And so you have these, it's all this experimenting with what's called geoengineering. And when I started studying climate and global cooling was the consensus because the world had cooled down from 1940 to 1980, and there were all kinds of experiments proposed. For example, they wanted to build a dam across the Bering Straits to stop the cold Arctic water coming into the North Pacific, and that would warm up the North Pacific and then warm up the world around that latitude. And they were talking about putting huge great reflectors up in space to direct sunlight into northern cities like Minnesota and warm them up in the wintertime. And of course, so all of these experiments with geoengineering have different reasons for them. They're all fatally flawed because we don't know what's going on. So, for example, back in the cooling, if you were trying to stop the cooling and then it was followed by the warming trend, you'd have made things worse. And this is the difficulty with it. And just to give you an example of the kinds of duplicities that governments get into with and by the way, I was 9 years in the Canadian Air Force chasing Russian submarines around the North Atlantic, and all this top secret briefings we got and so on, and people have no idea of the electronics and warfares that
sure.
go on.
Did you fly P-3s?
Yeah.
Yep.
Actually, I was on Neptune, and we had the Argus, which was a four-engine airplane. But I flew the Neptune. We called it the Neptune. But we were doing 18-hour patrols at a time. But most people don't know that all around North America, there are microphones on the continental shelf listening to traffic, the submarine traffic.
Oh, absolutely. Everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But one of the things, and I urge people to go and look up a ship called the Glomar Challenger. Now, the Glomar Challenger was ostensibly developed to pluck manganese nodules off the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. And the reason for that was that manganese was designated as a strategic mineral. It's very important in the production of high-grade steels and so on. And during the Cold War, and after they had put, because of our apartheid, they stopped trading with South Africa. Well, Russia and South Africa were the major sources of manganese. And so America had this problem that they've got to get manganese from somewhere. Well, manganese nodules are formed on the bottom of the ocean by bacteria taking in seawater extracting the minerals they need and then accumulating it in this nodule. Well, they developed this ship called the Glomar Challenger. It was designed to pick up these manganese nodules, but most of the money was put up by the CIA. And why did the CIA put up the money? Well, the answer is because a Soviet submarine sank in the Pacific Ocean in about 12,000 feet of water, and they wanted to recover that Soviet submarine to get all of the codes and the technology. Yeah, and they, and by the way, they got it halfway to the surface, and the submarine broke in half, and they only recovered half of it, but that was going to provide, it was as valuable as the Nazi coding machine Enigma.
Were the Soviets out there watching us at the time?
Oh yeah, one of the things that, for example, every time we had an exercise, an anti-submarine exercise, Soviet fishing vessels would show up and park right over the microphones on the bottom of the ocean, and they just sit there running their engines, so it swamped the ability.
I love it. Let's take a final call. Greg in Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Greg.
Mr. Norrie, good morning. I got a concern over the storms that you're worried about and their intensity. I've often left wondering why these 24-hour news cycles are showing buildings collapsing and washing out into flooded areas and whatnot. And I'm left wondering how much of this building should not have been put there in the first place.
True.
A lot of construction is taking place in areas where they shouldn't be constructing things.
Let's get your take on that, Tim. We only have about a minute left.
No, that is an extremely good point. And I was trying to bring up a management strategy for a whole drainage basin. And they said, well, why are people living in floodplains? If you go back and look at medieval cities in Europe, they didn't build in the floodplain. And now people want to be on the waterfront, and then when it floods, they expect somebody else to pay the bill for them. And what we need to do is look at the natural hazards of a region and plan accordingly. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And of course, you see it with hurricanes. I mean, if you're going to live in Florida, you're going to get hurricanes. So prepare for that. But one of the things to finish up with that point, George, is that people have lived with natural disasters because they live around volcanoes, even though they're going to explode because the soil is so fertile and it gives them a food supply. Most of the world's population live in the major deltas like the Ganges and the Nile. The reason is because of the food supply that they can produce. And of course, that's not necessary anymore, but that's why, as I said, you can put most of the world's population in about five of the world's major delta regions. So we're prepared to take risks in order to have a food supply, but with today's world, it simply isn't necessary anymore. You don't need to live in these environmentally dangerous areas.
Not at all. Tim, thank you so much. Tim, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories. And then our last hour, conversations with Linda, your calls.